So, translation.
After sitting in the above manner, make the mind remember the three transcendental letters A, U, M, and by regulating the breathing process, control the mind so as not to forget the transcendental seed. Okay. So if you have our PowerPoint show here, we got this picture of the yogi, famous BBT picture. It's very nice, sitting here on his deer skin on a mat, and his fingernails are like about 3 inches long, curled up. He's literally skin and bones, and his beard is hanging down to his waist, and there's looks like a tarantula crawling on his shoulder or something, and cats and dogs in the background like that, and he's chanting, Om, like that. So we were noticing, of course, that this verse, of course, is a part of the Bhagavatam, and it's connected. It has its own individual potency, but it certainly is connected to the whole Bhagavatam. And now after the preface of meeting Sukadeva Goswami and meeting Maharaj Pariksit in the first canto and understanding the circumstances, now we're ready to listen very attentively, to the Bhagavatam as spoken by Sukadeva Goswami. So Maharaj Pariksit's question is, what should we do at the time of death and during our life? And then Sukadeva Goswami answers, and I've extracted some text now, and if you read this here from 2.1.14, it says, Maharaj Pariksit, now your duration of life is limited to 7 more days. So during this time, you can perform all those rituals which are needed for the best purpose of your next life. Okay. So, think about this for ourselves. If you actually really thought, okay, today's Friday, and next Friday, in the same time, I'm going to be checking out of this body, what would you do? Maybe beg, borrow, or steal. Take all your credit cards and go and get whatever ticket is available to get you to Vrindavan, like that. Even if it costs, $4,000, whatever. Okay. Yeah. So there's certain things. And then you got some time and make some arrangements so you won't be burdened by your body, whatever the conclusion is going to be. So he's saying this. You got 7 days. And okay, it is. You can make a practical, preparation in this world, for your next birth. And it can be, what do you call it, best purpose. It can be a nice next birth. So he's telling him something very practical. And next he says, at the last stage of one's life, one should be bold enough not to be afraid of death. Yeah? But one must cut off all attachment to the material body and everything pertaining to it and all desires thereof. I always remember Lokanath Maharaj. He was talking about somebody's lying on his bed in the hospital and, just gasping to barely breathe, and all the families gathered around, and some people are just waiting for him to go to collect the inheritance, and other people are crying, and, at the last minute, his wife is shoving the new granddaughter in front of him and saying, here, see your granddaughter. Like that. Remember me. And they're all shoving their faces and consciousness into the poor guy at the last minute. So we cut off all these attachments, to this is not my body. This is not my bodily relationship as wife, as child, as grandfriends, as house, as car, like that. And bold enough not to be afraid of death. So very interesting instructions. In the world classical literature, this is quite something. And then 16, one should leave home, Sukadeva Goswami tells Maharaj Pariksit, and practice self-control. In a sacred place, he should bathe regularly and sit down in a lonely place, duly sanctified. Yeah. So if you're taking three baths a day, and of course it allows you to empty your digestive system properly, the cold water, cool water, it cools down the muscles and the fat and forces the blood back into the internal organs, like the brains and the liver and spleen for purification. So if you're tired, if you take a bath like that, evacuate everything, then it refreshes you, you know. Okay, so this is useful. And then a sacred place. And sanctify your sitting place. You know? And of course, I think most of us do this. If we have some place we regularly sit, like an office or usually you see, I guess many families, the husband and wife have their chairs. And their chairs are in front of the home entertainment system, you know. And they have these, you know, big stuffed chairs with levers in the side to lift the feet up, push the back back. And next thing they have a certain kind of illumination system, a light. They have their control wands. They have a table for their drinks and their reading materials, you know. So it's very, very practical, very normal to sanctify, spiritualize your sitting place, like that part of Vastu. Okay. Then, so this is what we're describing now, is, you know, is to do these preliminary things, but then it goes on. We'll jump ahead in the future in text 22, we'll see that Maharaj Sukadeva Goswami's advice for how to get ready for the last moment for the time of death includes this. The fortunate King Parikshit, inquiring further, said, this is text 22, O Brahmana, please describe in full detail how and where the mind has to be applied and how the conception can be fixed so that the dirty things in a person's mind can be removed. So because before we're describing these techniques, you know, what to do and chant Om and everything else, but then he'll ask, okay, I'm becoming purified, everything else, but what is the real content that you're recommending for meditation? So then in 23, Sukadeva Goswami answers, one should control the sitting posture, regulate the breathing process by yogic pranayama, and thus control the mind and senses. Then with the intelligence, apply the mind to the gross potencies of the Lord, the Virat Rup. So here's the content, you know. He's recommending his first meditation should be meditation on the Virat Rup. He continues in next text, this gigantic manifestation of the phenomenal world as a whole is the personal body of the Absolute Truth, wherein the universal resultant past, present, and future of material time is experienced. So this is the first step in God realization. It's the chapter title, and this is the beginning of Sukadeva Goswami's preaching education to an enthusiastic, sincere student. So for our own preaching experience, you know, prospective strategy, this seems to be, you know, a good strategy that first, somehow or other, Krishna will send, sincere people, motivated people. People will come to us, you know, at our workplace or something like that and say, oh, you know, somebody, so-and-so died or this happened. And so something, some motivation will be there, you know, to consider transcendence. And then we make a nice environment. Prabhupada told for the Bhaktivedanta Institute preaching, the first thing when the people come to our center, maybe you're inviting some scholars, even Nobel laureates, to come to the Bhaktivedanta Institute center for dinner. And so the first thing should be very nice reception. So when they go there in their car, they should see, oh, we're going to a nice part of town. Oh, it's a nice, a little bit older, nice building, nicely, nicely kept gardens in front. We ring on the doorbell, and some very, you know, nice-looking young girl receives us, dressed in a very nice Indian, you know, sari. And she receives my wife and myself and takes our hats and coats and recognizes us even, my goodness, you know, and says, please come in. The other guests are sitting here. And we're introduced properly. We're given a nice seat. So Papa says the first thing is nice reception. And the second thing he said is nice prasadam, like that. And then after that, preaching. Yeah. So formula for the BI in general is that we have to include this in our preaching program. You know, hey, buddy, you aren't the body. You know, you and your wife are a bag of stool. You know, first reception, you know, glorification of the person so he feels properly situated, properly appreciated. And then a nice prasadam, mercy. You know. And then we can talk about logic and philosophy like that. You know. And then what's the first thing we talk about? Different people. But here's Sukadeva Goswami, and again, we see this, that the person has to appreciate, you know, Krishna in nature, in the Virat Rup, the taste in water, the fragrance of the earth, the light of the sun, the Himalaya mountains. You know? And if somebody has already done this, okay, we can maybe go to the next step, which is an introspection, intuition, and that's rare. We're trying to do this work with Carl Jung, and with that we're coming in contact with people, you know, also with theater, the people that have some appreciation, not just that it exists or sometimes, but they have even some scientific way of relating to and developing, you know, and getting in contact with intuition, intuition, insight, inspiration, paramatma. You know. So this chapter is how to, get people focused, you know, on the Virat Rup and appreciate it. And of course, it's so natural, it's so nice. I'm looking out our window now, and it's pretty disgusting. Not disgusting, it's pretty depressing. It's just, there's four lanes, you know, going of traffic going this way and that way on this black, black asphalt service. And all the cars I noticed are either black or gray or white or red. It's almost all the cars, those three colors. You know? And then across the street is the back of a not too successful mall, strip mall that used to be the center of the town, but now it's falling down to used cigarette store. Not used, I'm sorry, discount cigarette stores, you know, real estate agencies, you know, and this, you know, it's pretty depressing. Yeah? But at the same time too, I think, well, I'm the ability in man, and I see people coming and going and unloading and loading stuff, and I'm attracted. What are they doing? You know, these two big trucks who showed up and basically figured out that the dollar store has got two big containers here, and they're using this as kind of like a regional warehouse for their other stores in the area to get ready for Christmas. And across the street there is a little open area with some trees, you know. So it does have its animating effect, and we get a good view of the sky. We go out on our porch and walk back and forth and chant. And the sky here is pretty nice, you know, with good views like that. You know? And so it purifies us. It elevates us. You know? And then we can start to get free from the senses and start to go into the Krishna in the mind, in the heart, that incarnation. And then we can get even more inspiration about specific kinds of service, and which gets even more fixed. And, you know, we can see the smile on Krishna, on the deity then, and get an even more higher connection. But the beginning, he's saying, you know, fix your mind on the Virat Rup. So then today's verse, of course, is part of that, which is chanting the Omkara, which he's recommending for him. So Prabhupada has a very nice purport, all about basically the Pranava Omkara. So he says, Omkara, or Pranava, is the seed of transcendental realization. And it is composed of the three transcendental letters, A, U, M. By its chanting by the mind, in conjunction with the breathing process, which is a transcendental but mechanical way of getting into trance, as devised by the great, by the experience of great mystics, one is able to bring the mind, which is materially absorbed, under control. Die. So if you can see our PowerPoint show, we broke this down into different levels of logic. So basically it says, Omkara is the seed of transcendental realization. One is able to bring the mind, which is materially absorbed, under control. But then Prabhupada has all these like sub qualifiers, what is it composed of? And then it has to be, chanted by control. With that, you have to have a control of the breathing process. What is the breathing process? Where does it come from? So this is like one of these Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati sentences, which actually are extremely, complicated. You and I, and I think Prabhupada more later, would break them into simple sentences like that. But in Bhakti Siddhanta's time, they were used to communicating in these paragraph-long, qualified sentences. And you'd speak one of these long, very sophisticated, qualified sentences to somebody, and his intelligence, you would be able to pick it all up right away, put it into proportion like that, and then compose another sentence just as complicated and complex and send it back to you. So the Brahma Samhita is like that. Hari Vilas said they translated it into French in the very beginning, but somebody they couldn't follow what Bhakti Siddhanta was saying, really. So all they had was just, basically it was like a literal translation, And they thought they would impress the French people with how intelligent they were, because French people are very, proud of that. French literature, of course, is amongst the greatest in the world. So he said he was out on Sankirtan distributing this kind of brahmacharya guy. And he said this guy came, he gave it to one guy, and after about, 15 minutes, this guy came back, French guy. He was completely irate. He was just almost livid, changing color. He said, I have been trying to understand this for 15 minutes. He said, it means nothing, nothing. He was just, saying, and Hari Velocity couldn't say much because it was a fact. When you give a literal translation, it meant nothing. It was just a collection of words. And so anyway, these purports in the beginning, I think maybe before Prabhupada really, tuned into our level of intelligence in the West, some of them you really have to analyze them, break them down, slow down, and see that there's tremendous information packed in here. It's a mechanical but transcendental way. Prabhupada talks about that many times, many mechanical though transcendental tricks. It means they're mechanical, but you can use them. You can use them. You can sit a certain way. You can roll the beads on the Hare Krishna and hold them constant on the Hare Rama. You can try and chant a certain number of mantras for each breath. You can try and chant a certain number of mantras walking one direction in the temple room and a certain number of walking back. And if it works, okay. These are all tricks to get the mind under control. But once the mind is actually experiencing some bhava, some sentiment like that, some feeling, okay, then we work with that. We try and develop the higher thing and keep that going, But of course, in the beginning, maybe we can't do that. It's quite natural, So then learning these tricks and stuff like that. To continue, this is the way of changing the habit of the mind. My goodness, the mind has its habit. The mind is not to be killed. Mind or desire cannot be stopped, but to develop a desire to function for spiritualization. Not to be stopped, but to develop, it's not to be stopped, but to develop a desire for spiritualization. The quality of engagement by the mind has to be changed. The quality of engagement by the mind has to be changed. So you've got to just think about different things. I find myself, I just, so many times I focus on being harassed by people bigger than me. Like, you know, if somebody in ISKCON like mentally harasses me and everything else, some, you know, with some power, then I'll my mind will try and relive it again and again, and trying to adjust it this way and that way. You know, so I have this real, what's the word, like a victim, I kind of like get my rasa from being a victim, you know, and things like this, you know, and dealing with it. But then sometimes I just, with psychology, okay, you can find out why, all this stuff. But other times it's effective just to push it aside. Don't even figure out the intermediate causes, just push it aside and chant Hare Krishna and develop your whole spiritual life and let this whole complex of the habits of the mind, just kick them out, you know, like that. Don't even try and disassemble them one by one. But Prabhupada says that this artificial repression can sometimes be worse than the original problem. So you have to be careful, you know, using artificial repression like that, and understand to what degree we actually have to go through and disassemble these different, you know, misunderstandings, you know, bad intelligence, bad logic, you know. In the picture, we found a nice picture of a crow and a swan, because the mind can be like a crow looking for mucus and garbage, or it can be like a swan looking for peaceful, clear water full of lotuses and other swans to quack and play with. Then, Prabhupada continues, the mind is the pivot of the active sense organs, and as such, if the quality of thinking, feeling, and willing is changed, naturally the quality of actions by the instrumental senses will also change. You know? So if we can work on the mind, you know, with jnana yoga, developing a logic and everything else that will keep the mind, you know, in a certain direction, okay. But if we can't do that, then we take advantage of the spiritual master, you know, people who are on that level, who can engage our senses in spiritual activities. And then the content of the mind will also be changed, you know, just by focusing on those spiritual activities. We say thinking, feeling, and willing. So the word feeling is a little bit sometimes, I think, misunderstood. First I have a thought, and I walk into the kitchen, I see a beautiful cake, you know, and I'm thinking about the cake, okay. Now next is feeling. So sometimes we take this as sentiment, you know, but actually it is acceptance or rejection. And it's interesting because when Carl Jung uses the word the same way, and he has to explain it to other psychologists of his time, because they also take it as sentiment, he said, no, it's evaluation. What are your feelings about this? Well, I don't like it. I do like it. So first the mind thinks about the cake, the thought is there. Then the mind has a feeling, basically acceptance or rejection, attraction or revulsion. Okay, if the mind is attracted, then willing. Now, how I will cut the cake, I'll cut a little piece out and then squeeze it back together and smooth the frosting over, and my mother will never know that I stole part of her cake for her bridge party. You know, thinking, feeling, and willing. You know? Of course, this is the mind, manas. And buddhi, intelligence, supplies perspectives, attitudes upon which we think, subconscious, and it supplies memories, you know, and thinking systems, you know, programs, you know, about how to think, like that. You know. And then find the senses, they just pretty much, they react. They have some intelligence, even neurophysiologically. The nerves in your fingers, they reach the spine. And many times there are ganglion, little nexuses there where they come together, and a little processing goes there before it even goes to the brain. Like, for example, if you touch something very hot, which could damage your hand immediately, the nervous will send the information to the ganglion, and they won't wait for it to go to the brain for processing. Right in the ganglion, there'll be an automatic stimulation of a muscle contraction, which will just withdraw your hand. So built into our body are these real immediate, you know, reflexes that don't even get to the brain like that. It's interesting. Let's go on here. So I discussed this. Thinking, feeling, and willing. And it's so powerful, this process. And some people are absorbing their senses. They just can't control themselves, like a dog. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending. He's just overwhelmed by these experiences. And us ourselves too. Certain experiences we know are just too much. Can't control ourselves. Or else very difficult to control ourselves like that. So, and other people are not on the senses. They're more focused on the mind. And so then they identify with their mind, and they become just, victims of their mind. It says that Vritrahari is a Mayavada Brahmachari, very famous, from the 4th century or something. He says, even Lord Brahma hesitates to put an obstacle in the path of a woman in the mode of passion. So sometimes, ladies know, that my mind just gets fixed on something, and my God, I just, okay, you can use that for Krishna, and then you get the job done. Everybody else is spaced out, motivate people. But other times it can be a big problem because the intelligence just becomes overwhelmed. I don't care what it's doing to my senses, but I just have these thoughts and my estimates and my willing. So sometimes we become absorbed in the mind and its activities, so much that, again, it's like a great ocean liner, plowing through the sea, Thinking, feeling, and willing. Okay, where we go here? Sound. Omkara, Prabhupada says, is the seed of all transcendental sound. And it is only the transcendental sound which can bring about the desired change of the mind and senses. Shrima Bhagavatam ki jai. Harinam Sankirtan ki jai. Even, Prabhupada says, even a mentally deranged man can be cured by treatment of transcendental sound. I guess, how many people in the audience are laughing now when they think about that? I think about this. I'm a mentally deranged man half the time. Okay. There was one guy who came to our little preaching center in San Francisco. It wasn't very big. It was nice. Nice program. It was residential, everything. But the big temple was in Berkeley. And he had, very severe emotional problems. I guess he was neurotic, severe neurotic and almost psychotic, But he was an outpatient. He was about, 40 years old. And he slept with his mother until he was, 13 years old, or something. So he had all these, very severe emotional problems. But somehow or other, he started coming to the temple for Gaur Artik, And he would dress himself up with a suit, with a tie and stuff, kind of a skinny guy. But he was very, almost inarticulate, couldn't talk very much. But he would come there and stand there, during the Artik. And I can't remember if he would stay for class or that kind of stuff. And for sodomy take, But he just, every day wouldn't cause a disturbance. He'd come for the Gaur Artik, maybe there's 5-7 devotees, little temple. And then after some time, he started moving from foot to foot, with the rhythm like that, going left to right, left to right. Then after some time, he actually started to clap, like that, so on, And so actually what Prabhupada is saying here, even a mentally deranged man can be cured by treatment of transcendental sound. So even animals, you give, in the zoo, if you have nice sound, like that, the bears, the animals, they just change. They become jolly, they become friendly, resourceful, playful. And so the sound is the whole first atmosphere. If you have a restaurant, we had this restaurant in Lima, and they wanted me to give some advice about, like, you know, decorating or that kind of stuff. So I went there, and I was looking at the, you know, this and that, the color of the paint, and I was thinking that the first element is the sound, you know. I was remembering that. So I just stopped and I listened, you know, lunchtime. Then I asked the devotees, you listen, you know. And they would say, wow, yeah. There was no doorway on the big kitchen entrance, so all the noise of cooking with the pots and everything else was coming out. And the walls in the place were flat, you know, sharp surfaces. So all the conversations were just bouncing off, and people were talking louder to hear each other. You know? So we put doors on the kitchen. We hung some, you know, some tapestries to absorb the sound, the walls. And we started always an appropriate lunchtime, you know, kirtan, the pace and the thing they wanted. And the whole atmosphere changed, you know, everything. You know, they started getting plants and people, everything else like that, so on. You know? So even a mentally deranged man can be cured by treatment of transcendental sound. Okay. In the Bhagavad Gita, the pranava omkar has been accepted as the direct, literal representation of the supreme absolute truth. One who is not able to chant directly the holy name of the Lord, as recommended above, can easily chant the pranava omkar. So some temples I've seen, like in, I remember especially Ecuador, they had a whole program, like they would, you know, close the lights down, they would have these, you know, little candles and glass things set out, and they would all chant Om and stuff for some time, you know. And after that, then they would do a very, very, like, you know, a mystical kirtan like that and so on, you know. And it was nice. I liked it. The devotees liked it. It was nice, you know. But also, of course, it attracted a lot of people. And usually we explain for impersonal perspectives that on the you try and open up yourself. You open your throat, you open your mouth, you open your chest, you open your stomach, and you open up everything. And of course, you can practice that opening up more and more until you are absolutely open as far down as you can go. And on the you start to close it up. You close it up from your kundalini chakra through your stomach, through your diaphragm, through your chest, up through your throat. And so you're pushing the whole sound up gradually on the until finally it goes out the highest exit, which is not your mouth, but it's your nose. And so like the M is actually like in bonjour, like in France. So the actual sound is it feels good. It's nice. And so that's what we do in terms of explaining it to get people to think, okay, there's a reason for this, you know, so on. But of course, Jiva Goswami says the three syllables are actually Radha, Krishna, and Jiva, like that. So when we're chanting Om, we're actually, you know, all together there, us in the service of Radha and Krishna. And the Omkara is a note of address, such as, O my Lord, just as Om Hari Om means, O my Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So if you can see our graphic here, who's in the picture? There's one lady addressing somebody. Who is that? Well, if we click here, it's Mr. President. So what's her name? I forgot her name now. Mrs. Obama, she can be saying, Mr. President. That's kind of, if she is, it's joking. If she would never say Mr. President, pretty much, except as a joke, or to conform to his position in public like that, and people might understand that, this situation, even the First Lady, you know, she says, Mr. President, or she might say, President Obama, or she might say Barack. She would never say that in public, but in the house and that, everything else. And then maybe under some circumstances she would say, honey, like that. So if during some inaugural address or something like that, State of the Union address, you know, she raised her hand and waved her program and said, oh, honey, and everybody would be like shocked, you know. So this Omkara, Prabhupada says, it's just like that. It's like a way of calling, saying Krishna, you know. The gopis as a joke might say, Om Bhagavan, like that. Okay, let's move on here. As we have explained before, the Lord's holy name is identical with the Lord himself. So also is Omkara. The persons who are unable to realize the transcendental personal form or name of the Lord on account of their imperfect senses, in other words, the neophytes, so we get more perfect senses as we become Madhyamadikaris, are trained to the practice of self-realization by this mechanical process of regulating the breathing function and simultaneously repeating pranava omkar within the mind. Yeah. So our senses do actually become purified. Prabhupada says we have to accelerate the senses. And at that point, they can respond to the existing transcendental information from the holy name, the deity. As we have several times expressed, since the transcendental name, form, attributes, pastimes, etc. of the personality of Godhead are impossible to understand with the present material senses, it is necessary that through the mind, the center of sensuous activities, such transcendental realization be set into motion. Conclusion. The devotees directly fix their minds on the person of the absolute truth. Okay? But one who is unable to accommodate such personal features of the absolute is disciplined in impersonality to train the mind to make further progress. And so I think it's basically our presentation here. Yeah. And again, the translation, after sitting the above manner, make the mind remember the three transcendental letters, A, U, M. And by regulating the breathing process, control the mind so as not to forget, this is smarnam, no? The transcendental seed. Okay, so thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. And if you want more information about our work, you can go to our webpage, jayarama.us. So any questions, complaints, comments?
Can I ask a really quick question here at the beginning?
Get me
out of the way. Okay. You know, that was I very much like your... I've got to mute somebody. Just one second.
Somebody's got a hammer going.
Okay. I very much liked how you said in detail about the pronunciation of Omkara. Because for years I've been puzzled. Everybody pronounces the pranava like om, but it's written out with three letters. And I thought because of the BBT guide for how to pronounce AU, it was ow. So I was thinking, is it om or om? But you were pronouncing all three letters, and it makes sense now. So it's
om.
Om. So if I guess you say fast, then it sounds like om.
Om. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, just don't forget to cook your offering for your deities tonight. Yeah.
But when it's in the guide for Sanskrit pronunciation, you know, that A-U, is it pronounced usually as ow, like out?
I forgot what they do. They supply, I think it's pretty good. They supply like some kind of like, you know, the way, of course the thing is, you know, this, in the South America, we part of the United States, we say like, you know, y'all, you know, you all, you know, like that. And so New York, they have their accent, you know. So I guess you need a separate pronunciation guide for New York, Louisiana, and Hawaii, like that. But that's the whole thing, is that even the Sanskrit, there's, you know, I guess the real pronunciation is Rama, you know, Bhima. That's the Sanskrit pronunciation. But both in Bengali and Hindi, you don't say that. You say Ram, Bhim, you know. And you really should foreshorten the last A a lot, which is more details on that. But there are, like, you know, in Bengali, you know, Soriro, you know, they, you know, joy. They don't say jai, they say joy. So even, you know, within the, yeah, with that, there are different pronunciations. But as far as I understand, that's the whole thing, that the Sanskrit pronunciation has to be correct for the mantras of the Rig Veda and those places to work. So in that sense, it's very specifically, because you do this, the whole thing, if you start like this, examining what it feels like when you chant ah or ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, how you change your vocal apparatus. And it's very, Sanskrit is extremely technical, extremely organized, how it pronounces the sounds like that. It's very logical if you look at it. There's three different factors for each sound, and then each one of those has a possible pronunciation. You know? You know, and it starts from the back of the vocal apparatus and moves to the forward. Ka, cha, ta, ta, ha. Yeah? You know? So, anyways, a great way to attract linguists, you know, is a little bit. And after that, we'll try and get to the content.
I have one other question, but I think I'll wait to see if others have something.
Comments?
I was thinking that when you're reading the purport, and Prabhupada mentioned mentally deranged could be purified by the holy name. And you were giving the example of this mentally deranged person that came to your preaching center. Actually, but as you were reading it, I was thinking the mentally deranged, I was picturing it more in my mind of the of all of us, anyone who's not Krishna conscious, that we look around in this world and everyone is like mentally deranged. Identifying with this body is really psychotic.
That's why I mentioned that. How many of us are laughing when we hear that, because we realize that we're all mad.
Yeah.
Like that. Wow.
You're really deranged. And I guess there's different levels of being deranged. Perhaps, say, someone in the mode of goodness, or maybe a brahmana who is having some understanding that he's not his body. And he understands a little bit of the goal of life, but yet he hasn't come to the level of understanding a personal relationship with Krishna. He's also deranged to some degree, but maybe not nearly as ill. As
I was over at Kroger's yesterday trying to get an extension cord or something, and I walked through the ice cream section, you know, and it was unbelievable. It was like about 25 feet of different kinds of ice cream. And I was attracted. I was like, what is like that? You know? So somebody else is attracted to the meat department, but then, okay, if you're saying we're still, like, we're mentally deranged, how many different kinds of ice cream do you need?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you so much for giving class. I actually have two questions. One is about the purport, and one is about something else.
Okay.
So the last sentence of the purport says, but one who is unable to accommodate such personal features of the Absolute is disciplined in impersonality to train the mind to make further progress. So does that mean that there's actually value in learning about the impersonal feature or teaching the impersonal feature?
Yeah, and there's, of course, there's different levels of impersonal feature. You know, one is the kind of white light conception, which I don't know if that's going to do, or staring at a candle. But the Virat Roop is not Krishna as a person. You know, is you're appreciating nature, which always has existed and which always will exist, and in all places, all times, so omnipresent. omni, what's the other one, omnipresent, something else, you know, all times, eternal, you know. And so that's Brahman, you know, Brahmans, it's impersonal, but it's a step in the right direction then, you know, because, you know, once you come to the kingdom, you get some catastrophe in your kingdom, so you gather up your family and your brother's family, and you all escape, and you go to some other place, and people receive you properly, and they get you refugee place, and find out what you can do, and you know things are well maintained, it's well defended, and so you're experiencing the impersonal, you know, manifestation of the government of the king, and with some intelligence, you see the king here and there being, you know, communicated, and you realize, oh yeah, yeah. And so just by, in the beginning, by appreciating what kind of country it is, you know, you begin to get this focus on the king ultimately. Yeah? And then Paramatma, okay, now you're a qualified person, so you're asked to participate in different community projects, you know, building this dam or defense. And so you're in different committees with the king and maybe 10, 15 other people. And sometimes you raise your hand and make some comment, he'll answer and talk to you. And you begin to, you know, Paramatma is intellectual exchange, you know. But then one day afterwards, he says, "Oh, you're from so and so." You say, "Yes, sir, I'm from there." And he says, "What's your aunt's name?" And you say, "Your aunt." And he said, "That's also my aunt." And he says, "We're cousins, you know." And you go, "Oh my goodness, you know." He says, "Can you get a moment? Come on, have lunch with me." So then it goes from, you know, Brahman, you're in the kingdom. Paramatma, you're in the committees and exchanging intellectual communication. And finally, Bhagavan, then it's a personal relationship and exchanging the sentiments and heartfelt things. So there's value. It's, you know, different people are on different levels. And we are completely purified too, so it's also value for us to also, you know, appreciate the importance of the impersonal aspect and, you know, to appreciate water and clean places and that kind of stuff. The birds are Krishna's sense of artistic ability. So whenever I remember that, I look at the birds and I stop and I look and I see, wow, pretty interesting. Now, wow, what kind of artist did this? It's not evolution, not necessary for evolution. It's a beautiful artist in butterflies too. So yeah, I think there's definitely value for different people on different levels.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj, Balabhadra here.
I think Mataji had one more question there.
Okay. No
problem. Thank you for your perspective on that. I really appreciate that. Now I want to go memorize everything. When I first joined, and I joined in 1990, so I've been told by others that maybe that wasn't the best of ISKCON's history. I don't know. That's when I joined. So the first time you do something is what you always feel is the best or the right.
Yeah,
so
that's a fact. Yeah.
Now I'm trying to adjust a little. But anyway, when I first joined, Kartik started on the full moon, started the day after the moon and ended on the full moon. And now, according to the calendar I have, it starts on the full moon and ends the day before. So this full moon tomorrow is Sri Krishna Rasa Yatra, but the full moon we had last time, October 18th, was Sri Krishna Saradiya Rasa Yatra, and I was wondering which one of those is the Rasa dance in Krishna book, and so which one of those is the day we put sweet rice on the roof?
I think you put sweet rice on the roof on both of them.
Right. Yeah.
But okay. But I don't know. I don't know which one it is exactly. I'm not that good at it. But I also favor the one too, because the first day of the month is called Pratipat, which means the first day, then Dvitya, which is the second day, Tritya, Ekadasi, 11. So also I think, you know, that Damodar month starts in the first day, and the Purnima is the Damodar Purnima, like that. So I don't know which one is the one in the Krishna book. I don't know which one is which. I don't know.
So the last day of the month is Purnima.
That's according to my taste. But you know, but different people have different views, and you know about things.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Hare Krishna. This is Balabhadra.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Jai Dandavas, first Prabhupada.
Oh my goodness.
Actually, it was just a comment to Mataji's first question about the impersonal conception. I was just looking to share a passage from the purport of the last verse of the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, where Prabhupada speaks about the impersonal conception. And he says, the impersonal conception of the Supreme Absolute Truth, as described in this chapter, which is the 12th chapter, is recommended only up to the time that one surrenders himself for self-realization. In other words, as long as one does not have the chance to associate with a pure devotee, the impersonal conception may be beneficial. In the impersonal conception of the Absolute Truth, one works without fruitive result, meditates, and cultivates knowledge to understand spirit and matter. This is necessary as long as one is not in the association of a pure devotee.
Jai is my standard. And of course, an association of pure devotee means also you've got to be able to take advantage of it, no? Because, I mean, some people with Prabhupada, they couldn't appreciate who he was, you know?
I just find it's rather interesting how Prabhupada, well, for a brief moment, speaks favorably about the impersonalist view path and viewpoints, considering how much stress he has spoken against it.
I think, if it's progressive, because Sukadeva Goswami, everybody else, the four Kumaras, if it's progressive, it's okay, you know. But it's when people use it to deny the personal existence. You know, even some of the Mayavadis, they know Krishna has a personal form, but they don't like it. And so therefore they stress the impersonal feature, and they say the personal feature is just sentimentalism and it's an inferior thing, like that. Because then they can be the person, like that. Yeah, Krishna's not a person. Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Other questions, comments?
So, Maharaj.
Oh, yes, sir.
Dandava.
Hare Krishna.
Okay, so in first in purport, I have a lead with a short question.
Oh, my goodness.
You mentioned Jiva Goswami writes somewhere about the Omkara representing Radha Krishna in Jiva.
Yes.
Where is that?
I don't know exactly. It's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. My memory of it is, when I first read it, I read it a couple times, and maybe in my notes someplace, was a Krishna book-sized Chaitanya Charitamrita, so that would mean it was like, what is it, the first volume? Maybe chapter 7. Adilila chapter 7, like that. But it's in Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Not Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, CC.
It might be. It might be mentioned a couple other places like that too, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
I have read it myself. It is so. I've read it that way.
Where?
Believe it or not, I'm looking for it right now. But I did read it just recently.
Okay, I'll give you a few minutes. I'm going to say a few things. I remember many years ago, one devotee, he began a preaching program. Maybe he was in front of a yoga group. So he did a long Omkara, you know, Om, Om, and then he breaks into like, and then at the end of it he goes, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
John.
You know, and Gayatri starts with Om.
Yeah.
And the Bhagavatam starts with Om. And it's interesting that Sukadeva Goswami begins with this his preaching to Maharaj Parikit, you know, with this Om. Of course, you know, it's well known that Maharaj Parikit was a devotee from birth, but Sukadev, he also has an extended audience of impersonal yogis and rishis that revere him, so he may be walking them through a meditation that will ultimately introduce them to the personal feature, the absolute. So, you know, because we're about to launch into the Bharat Rup, you know, which is something I can hardly relate to. But this Om, it's very interesting. This Om, it's very powerful. And by chanting this long Om, I've done it myself and also in a group setting. And in the group setting, the facilitator said, take a long breath, and on the outgoing breath, just chant Om as long as you can, and then take your breath and start. And the group, because people were taking breaths at different times, it wasn't broken. It was a constant drone. And it was very powerful. I remember at the end of it, you know, we all stopped, and it was the silence was deafening, and I was the one that I was like so shocked at the effect that I kind of laughed, and it kind of broke the you know the gravity of the moment, you know, for everyone. I didn't mean to, but I was like totally surprised. So this Om, it automatically, as it's mentioned in the purport, Prabhupada touches on this, it automatically regulates your breathing, and breathing is connected with consciousness. And I don't know if you've had this understanding, but japa also regulates your breathing. So by chanting Om, which Prabhupada points out in the purport, is the literal representation of the Supreme Lord, as stated by Krishna himself in Bhagavad Gita, it is interesting to note that Srila Prabhupada says if one is unable to chant the holy name directly, one can easily, you know, easily chant Om. So I'm thinking like, and it's also a mechanical, it's mentioned in the purport that Omkara, the Omkara is meant for detaching the mind from the mundane plane. So if the mind is agitated in so many ways by material mental activities, and this works against us chanting the holy name, and especially japa, a continual stream of consciousness, because sometimes the mind is jumping from one thing to the other. So this Om detaches the mind from the mental turbulence and makes it peaceful. And it's a mechanical process for sure, but it may be favorable for some persons to set up their mind for chanting Gayatri or the Maha Mantra. Because, you know, the holy name reveals the form, qualities, and pastimes of the Lord. But if the mind's too materially contaminated, it may be difficult to chant the holy names with full attention. So that some people, I'm not promoting this, I'm not trying to create a heresy here, but some people may derive some benefit by chanting the Omkara first, just a few minutes. And you were mentioning about the nasal passage being the top exit for sound or something. I have this experience, and my voice teacher, Brihan, who might be on the call, mentioned this, caught me by surprise by mentioning this, but you can resonate sound within your head. It's like the middle ear. I don't know if everybody has this ability, but it almost feels like there's a hollow space in between, you know, maybe it's because I'm missing some brain substance, but anyway. Anyway, the sound resonates between the ears. If you hit it in a particular way, it just fills the head. The sound fills the head. And to chant Om like that is very powerful. And it does have a very, very powerful effect on the mind.
What about also because we chant Ah, but what about Ha? If you chant these things slow and look at the vocal apparatus, it's interesting. So the word Hare is also a very interesting Bija mantra in terms of this. Ha, ha, it's different. It's ha, the Ha is even more open than the Ah, because the Ha pushes more air out than the Ah, it seems. And the ray is interesting because it comes up to the nose, like that, so on. Yeah. Yes.
And then Balabhadra.
Very well.
Did you find the reference?
I wrote it down somewhere. Now I can't find the paper that I wrote it on. I did find one reference where Prabhupada says that the A stands for Krishna.
Okay. Yeah.
So, I'm looking to see where I got that reference from right now. Here we go. Omkar. I'm still scanning here.
Does anybody else have any questions or comments? I should maybe get a little bit going here. It's just 11:15. I have to go. I got to go to the bank.
Hanuman Swamiji, this is Mahesh calling.
How's your good wife?
I'm doing very well, thank you. We are listening both your wonderful class.
We're both born on Guam, remember that?
Yes.
I was also born on Guam.
Oh, wow.
Yes, we're both Guamanians.
Guamanians. Okay. You know, I have a question here. It seems like the purport there and the verse in the Bhagavatam is talking about silent meditation, not just chanting the Om.
Yeah, it is. Prabhupada says in the mind. In the mind, he says several times like that.
So in other words...
Which is maybe different than in the head. In the mind is, you know... In the mind, in Vedic culture, would be more in the heart, you know, rather than in the head.
So the meditation that the Bhagavatam was recommending was sitting in a solitary place in silent meditation?
Yeah. Prabhupada says that several times in the purport. He says... What it mentions many times is first you're going to do it with your senses, and then after the senses are under control, then you're going to it's called pratyahara. Then you withdraw into the mind, and of course in the mind, the beginning may be in the brain, but after you become more detached, you go into the heart, you know. So that, you know, the om ultimately, and here it mentions, you know, breathing process, and then fill the mind. So several times, yeah, it's a silent meditation the way it's being described ultimately. Ultimately. So any final comments or questions here? Okay. So I guess I want to thank everybody very much. This is always a very nice part of our week. And actually, we take much more time than we should these PowerPoint shows. It's for such one of our karma yoga, you know, putting them together like that. So thank you all very much. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.
Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna.
Jaya, Glitcha Shri Prabhupada.
Jai.
Thank you, Prabhu. Hare Krishna.
Thank you.